This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Idiot RPG plots.
Project Azorian.
The Green Man.
And Eric Von Daniken.
Robin, I just saw a tuxedo cat change into a red cape, then leap off the town hall clock tower. Have I been sniffing too much catnip?
You just saw a super kitty, Ken. We're not in River City anymore. Welcome to Meowtropolis, the brand new superhero setting for the Magical Kitties Save the Day RPG.
Super kitties? I thought being magical was already pretty impressive. You're telling me these cats have secret identities now, too?
Precisely. In Meowtropolis, your kitty is a caped crusader, protecting the bustling city from diabolical supervillains. We're talking secret hideouts, origin stories, and power quirks that add the earth-shattering kaboom to your series.
Sounds like the stakes just got a whole lot higher. And the best part... The Meowtropolis Kickstarter goes live on March 24th.
It's got a possum slate of rewards, too. We've got the Meowtropolis Hometown Book, the Trouble in River City Adventure Collection, and even a new solo puzzle book called Mice's Gambit.
This is obviously the one I've been waiting for, but Kickstarter campaigns don't last forever. We'd better pounce on those rewards before the clock runs out.
Head to atlas-games.com/backmeow to set up your launch reminders now. That's atlas-games.com/backmeow.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And today in the gaming hut, our concern is with idiots and not, you know, Steve, God bless him. He's just, you know, distractible.
And not any Patreon backer Steves, but like the other Steve. We all know which Steve we're talking about.
The classic Steve as idiot example that we enjoy. No, never our Patreon backers. Robin, how can you even say such a thing? They're not idiots. They're noble and beloved, the paragons of humanity in every respect. Unlike people who write idiot plots, who are not those things. And it's bad enough when an idiot plot shows up in the movies or in the TV show. Someone has to be dumb as a post just for the next scene to happen. And it is, you argue, even worse when it happens in an RPG mystery. And I'm sure you're about to tell us why.
Right. So to just be absolutely clear about what idiot plotting is in general, that is when a story only works because someone has made a blunder, has done something dumb. And you may argue that in real life crimes, the sorts of things that lead to mysteries, people do dumb stuff all the time, especially the people who get caught do dumb stuff. And you may point to the work of Elmore Leonard as someone who very specifically keeps his stories fun and exciting and gripping while recognizing the deep fact that many criminals are deeply stupid or rash or driven by compulsions and, in fact, are criminals in large part because they lack impulse control and don't fit in regular society or just are none too bright. Dashiell Hammett famously, when referring to his time as a Pinkerton, said that he never met a smart criminal. And all of those things are accurate, but we will note that neither of them was really doing or at least using stupidity as the subject matter for a mystery that the protagonist is trying to figure out. And the reason for that is that in a fictional universe, we reject dumb behavior, including dumb behavior that happens in the real world. And the conspiracy theory, for example, that Charles Manson must have been put in place by the CIA is based on the fact that the police couldn't have possibly have made the terrible mistakes they made early on in that investigation, treating two identical murder scenes as unrelated. That can't be true. Everything has to make sense. It doesn't in real life, But in a role-playing game in particular, it is a problem when things don't make sense, Ken, which you were about to explain why.
The problem arises, much as it does in a TV show or in other passive entertainment, because you are depending on a logical structure to create the momentum of the story. The detective finds clues that mean a thing. The suspect breaks a pattern, and that break means something. It doesn't just mean they wanted tacos today instead of eggs. It means that they had to go across town and see their mistress and shut her up about this murder plot or whatever it happens to be. When Columbo spots a shift in someone's behavior, it's not the fact that people are always shifting behavior, especially LA rich people. It's that that is a sign of criminality. That is a sort of a structural load-bearing member of the mystery story, is that a pattern exists and a pattern that is broken is significant. That things that depart from the normal are pointers to the gross abnormality of the crime at the heart of things. And when you are doing it across the table to each other, the idiocy is even more stark because the players are clinging to the supposed world logic as literally the only thing they have to go forward on in the mystery. In a TV show, you can sort of say, oh, that's Patrick McGoohan. Clearly, he's the bad guy. Look at his smarmy face. But in a RPG, you can't really do that. Even if the GM says, he has a smarmy face, kind of like Patrick McGoohan, that's not necessarily a sign, because the acting isn't there. The rest of the inputs aren't there. You have to depend on, is there a clue? Did he go get tacos instead of eggs on the day of the murder? And it, does that mean something? And of course, it must mean something, because that is the sort of contract that you engage in when you engage in solving a mystery.
Right. So you're trying to put together, as players in a mystery game, a sequence of events. And in order for you to know what to put together, you're relying on the fact that there is cause and effect, that this person did X for this reason, and they know what they're doing to some extent, and what they're doing is not completely random. And often idiot plotting comes in as a shortcut by the scenario writer, or in other fields by the screenwriter or author, when you have created a storyline and then you spot a hole in it. And there's a bit that you meant to have make sense, and now it doesn't. And the temptation is to say, okay, but the henchman fell asleep in his truck, and that's why he didn't show up at this place in time. Or to come up with some justification that's outside the logic of the cause and effect. And the problem with that is the players have no way to incorporate that into their understanding of events, because it comes completely out of left field. It's a justification that you've used. So more so than real criminals, and even sort of more so than Elmore Leonard characters, the characters who are doing things that create the story that the players have to piece together need to be behaving in a reasonably predictable or understandable manner. And just being dumb, or just making mistakes, or, for example, being a mystery, for example, where someone kills the wrong person because their research was shoddy as to who they had to get vengeance against. You can do these things, and that's what the rest of our segment is going to be about, but you have to do them very carefully and signpost them really heavily, so that if you really want to do a story where you're unraveling an irrational action that leads to a mystery, you also have to have the players understand as early as possible that what this person is doing defies reality, or they are delusional, or whatever it is that's causing them to do things that break the normal cause of chain and effect and substitute a different one that is contingent on their being wrong or foolish or rash or impulsive. You have to make that like essentially the first thing that the players learn, right? That this person has no impulse control and believes that they are saving the world from aliens that don't exist. If they get that as part of the premise, even part of the briefing, then they're good. But if you reveal at the end that all of these disconnected events and actions were because of a set of delusions, your players are going to spend the entire scenario confused and be mad at you at the end when they find out the thing that sort of kind of made it all make sense.
Yeah, certainly the, you know, irrational murderer or the person who's doing something for insane or hyper real reasons is a core element of Cthulhu Mythos gameplay, for example. But the thing that you're solving then is not, why is this guy going on a rampage necessarily, or why did he pick that victim? It's more, what sent old Farmer Jed over the edge? And the answer is the, you know, monster in the old mill finally got to him and sent him on the rampage. So the rampage is actually just another clue to the monster rather than the thing that you're trying to solve. And as long as you can keep the players focused on the fact that this is one of a number of aberrant behaviors centered around this farmstead or this guy or this little town, then they have a better chance of realizing that the real mystery is what has deranged the reality of this little town or this farmstead, not why is Farmer Jed killing those left-handed salesmen, right?
Right. And so, again, make it very clear at the beginning that Farmer Jed has lost his human volition. There's some unearthly force acting upon him. And so then you're not asking yourself, why is Farmer Jed doing this? You know why that is. He's possessed by a Ithian or, you know, a renegade flying polyp or what have you. But now you know enough to go, well, what is the flying polyp trying to accomplish? And so you can then go and research flying polyps. You can figure out what it is that drives them, what they're doing, what they do when they possess a farmer, and then you can go from there. And again, that grounds the players in what is happening, and you don't have to have a, he was just, you know, mistaken about what went on here, or he just lost his temper and did this instead. You've got, again, you've got an alien logic, but there's still a logic. You've still got that cause and effect chain that can be reconstructed, provided that, of course, you have to give the players the tools to reconstruct a sequence of events from the point of view of a flying polyp.
And this can work with other sorts of seeming idiot plots where the evil Baron has done something and you're trying to figure out why he did that. And very early on, you discover that he's being fed bad intel by the vizier, who is up to no good. And so it's not the Baron's bad actions that you're trying to solve. You're trying to solve, is the vizier a necromancer? Is he in league with the orcs from across the ridge? What's going on? Why did he act on this bad intel? And maybe it's because he's been fed, you know, intelligence suppressing drugs. Maybe it's because he's a saphead and everyone's always known he's a saphead, which is another strong possibility in an aristocratic society, or whatever it is. So the misdirect, as long as it's the thing the characters know they're trying to solve, doesn't derail the story so much as if they're flailing around trying to figure out the Baron's actions. And at the very, very end, you say, oh no, the Baron was doing this all because he just got fed some bad data. Sorry. That is, at the very least, it's a terrible way to introduce the real mystery, which is, what's the vizier up to? And at the most, it's just an exercise in a total waste of time because they're over doing shadow boxing against something that isn't the real story. And that's annoying, you know, with any sort of red herring or side trail or side quest or whatever, unless the players have deliberately set off on the side trail. It's not the job of the GM to trap them in the dead end, right?
Right. Another reason scenario writer is sometimes tempted to have the antagonist make bad decisions is they want to justify how you could possibly take this very powerful being, often a supernatural being, down, given all the things that they can do. So you might be tempted to say, well, after, you know, hundreds of years, they're getting sloppy. So once again, you've got to foreground that is that, you know, your handlers inform you that, you know, the guy who runs the vampire arms dealing network in Bucharest has not only developed the sort of brain calcification that begins to overtake vampires as they fail to keep up with the times, But he's also got a giant Coke habit, and that has led him to get sloppy and to make the kinds of mistakes that he never would have made in the 1700s. And this finally means that he's vulnerable, and this network that's been impossible to take down for decades, now you've got your shot. And your goal then is to, the mystery might be, what is his next mistake going to be, right? You know that he's vulnerable. You know that he's doing things wrong. So that rather than the mistake that justifies the mystery yet confuses it, you can have that. The premise is, you know, this vampire is slipping. This is your chance. Go find out how to take advantage of this. And whether that means infiltrating their organization or trying to bolster their adversaries, whatever it is, again, that is not just here part of the premise, but it's the very thing you're trying to figure out, is what mistake are they going to make next that you can then capitalize on.
Right. Or how can you push them into further mistakes, even sort of setting up a, you know, this is your opportunity to go in and to present him perhaps with a tempting opportunity to make a giant mistake that you could then, you know, cut him off at the pass and round up all of these arms dealers in a satisfying way that will leave the vampires bootless in the upcoming warfare in, you know, Ukraine or Syria or wherever the vampires are fomenting warfare.
Right. And this means that you're shading into a con artist story more than a mystery.
Or a heist story.
Or a heist. And so once we're switching subgenres, I think it's time for us to switch huts entirely in what I guarantee will be an all-hut episode. So let's listen to this exciting commercial and then our next hut.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming in February from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife and a Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again,
A Stay in Bath Takes an Unexpected Turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws,
The Shakespearean Comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
A Love Triangle Unfolding from the Turbulent 60s to the Troubled 20-teens,
Behind the Music Drama in the L.A. Punk Scene,
The Arrival of a Telepathic Stranger on a Spacebound Way Station,
Tragic Love Between a Vampire and a Mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you,
whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define,
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
The background check that you had to undergo in order to listen to this, the retinal scan, and the suspicious whir of your webcam as it records your activities tell us that we're once more in that most top secret of huts, the Tradecraft Hut. And this time around, at the behest of Bulvard Patreon backer Ginge, we are going to find out the anomalous truth of CIA's Project Azorian. Possibly one of the best project names ever. It's like it's crying out to be on Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff. So Ken, take us back to February 24th, 1968, underwater.
Underwater. So this is the story, or it begins as the story, of a Soviet Navy submarine called the K-129. It's a diesel electric, in case you care. Heads out of Kamchatka on a seemingly hasty patrol mission. It is under the command of a captain named Captain Vladimir Ivanovich Kobzar. It heads out with a overstrength crew, 98 instead of 83, so they're on some sort of mysterious mission. It reaches the icy waters of the North Pacific, dives, reports, and then disappears. And it disappears on March 7th and does not check in after that. And so as it continues to not check in, the Soviet Pacific Fleet scrambles and goes looking for their missing sub. And as they're going looking for their missing sub, the American tracking subs that followed the Soviet fleet around start picking up all kind of great pings and chatter, and the Soviets are crossing the brand new SOSUS cables, the submarine sonar net that the United States has been slowly stringing across the entire ocean against just such an eventuality, and we get just gigantic amounts of intel about Soviet naval deployment and readiness. And in that intel, U.S. Navy Special Projects Office Chief Scientist John P. Craven, talk about people with great names, he heard a pop on the sonar that didn't sound like a torpedo going off, but he didn't know what it sounded like, and he thought maybe it was the submarine sinking. And so they sent the USS.
That's a gumshoe ability, Yusuf, if I ever heard one.
If I ever heard one.
A tiny pop.
Exactly. So they send the USS Halibut to the sound place, and the Halibut shows up in August of 68 and finds the K-129 broken into, but otherwise pretty much intact on the ocean floor. Halibut takes 22,000 pictures of the wreck, sends them to Washington. The Navy is ecstatic. Their first theory is that the submarine K-129 was charging its battery and produced too much hydrogen while charging its battery. The hydrogen caught fire on the surface and blew a hole in the submarine, and then it sank and fell to the bottom. Another possibility is a leak in a missile tube hatch that let seawater go into the tube, and if the missile propellant also leaked, seawater and missile propellant do not mix. They go off with a kaboom, and that may also have brought down the K-129. And we know that it's already happened.
This is why you rarely see me in a submarine, is
right.
The possibility, all these different ways that your submarine could go boom.
Right. And we know that this same thing happened to a different submarine in 86. So we know that it is possible on a Soviet sub for this thing to happen. And the Halibut pictures do seem to show one of the missile tubes blown out, which is another sign that maybe the tube leaked. So, right. So far.
And the two different ships that blew up were the K-129 and the K-219. So pick different numbers.
Right. Yeah. It's just don't let your submarine add to 12, I guess, is the message here.
Yeah. There's a numerology thing going on here, which we may get to later.
The numerology hut. So the Navy, having had a gigantic triumph of intelligence, it was up to the CIA to ruin it. And so the Navy said, let's just send down a deep diving mini sub and guys in armored underwater suits, and let's cut open the K-129. Let's take its nuclear missiles. Let's take its cipher machines and its code books, and then let's bounce and no one the wiser. And the CIA said, no, that could work. What we want to do is something super secret, such as build an immense seagoing crane ship that would sail to the location, lower an enormous claw 16,000 feet to the bottom of the ocean, grab a hold of the wrecked sub, and fish it up from the ocean floor.
You know that Helms has had a giant claw blueprint in his desk for years, just waiting for a possibility like this. Bring out the claw.
And someone says, this doesn't sound very top secret. And Helms says, no, it's even better. We are going to get drug-addled maniac Howard Hughes to build our boat, so everything will be totally secure. So they put out the cover story that Hughes was planning to mine manganese nodules from the bottom of the seabed. And I remember being a kid in the 70s reading you know, about the exciting new seabed industry of manganese nodule mining. So I came into contact with that dumb cover story as a young man. So the CIA codenames this whole thing Project Azorian, speaking of things they probably had in the desk. And Hughes had the Global Maritime Company build a 63,000-ton, 619-foot Glomar II, later known as the Glomar Explorer. It's built in November.
And the name is weird, but it comes from Global Maritime.
Right. It's built in November of 1972. So the CIA's plan, let's just keep in track. The CIA's plan has been to spend 6 years building the largest, most attraction-drawing boat in the entire Pacific Ocean and not do anything about the sub yet. So
yes, this is a realistic idiot plot that you can't have your characters.
You cannot do this.
It makes no sense.
So the ship sails out in spring of 74. They begin operations on July 4th. Sometime in August, the Claw, which is known as Clementine the Claw, in case you're curious, is lifting the K-129 and it snaps. And so the entire back half of the submarine falls down to the bottom and buries itself deep in the silt, including the code books and cipher machines that were the whole point of this mission. So it cost $800 million and got a Soviet submarine launched nuclear missile for its pains. And even before the Glomar gets back to port, unknown burglars have broken into Hughes's corporate offices and stolen his files, including the CIA memo explaining about how they funded the Glomar Explorer and what the Azorian mission was.
Yes, and before people were taking notes on a criminal conspiracy, they were leaving their top secret CIA memos in their safe.
Well, I mean, it's project management, I guess. You have to sort of, when do we build the giant claw? And so those documents make their way to Washington columnist Jack Anderson, who breaks the story in 1975.
Right. And so who exactly did the stealing of the documents remains shrouded in doubt and mystery, but they did also take cash and art. And later they tried to sell the confidential documents back to Hughes. So they're probably professional thieves, not CIA and not Delta Green. And so they're Parker probably. So Parker versus Delta Green seems like an interesting idea for another day. But of course, this echoes back in time to another break-in, because Watergate starts because the Nixon and his inner circle fear that a big payment that Hughes made to Nixon in 69 or 70, and that Nixon substantially used to refurbish his home, so straight up bribe, they were afraid that the former Hughes lobbyist turned DNC chairman Larry O'Brien had a file on this, and that's why they ordered the break-in at Watergate. So if you're feeling conspiracy-minded, you could possibly tie Watergate and then the later break-in that has the Glomar Explorer plans in them.
As a side note, often you will hear Azorian called Project Jennifer, for example, in the Charles Stross lovely supernatural novel, The Jennifer Morgue. There's other books called Project Jennifer. Jennifer was actually the security compartment in which Azorian was planned. So it's the code name around the code name. So you had to have Jennifer access to even know Azorian existed, and then you would have to have Azorian access to get the details of Azorian, or just be in Howard Hughes's office. Apparently that's the other way you could do it.
Right. And that sort of raises the possibility if you could have a character show up whose name is Jennifer Azorian. And,
right.
And that might be a totally different mystery, but you realize that she's chosen a code name that's a reference to this old security scandal. Why is she flouting that? So that could be a whole other code name related mystery.
So with something as dramatic and stupid as Azorian, obviously there must be a real story behind it. It can't just be that the CIA is terribly bad at its job. So the sort of the simplest version of the cover-up is that the colossal failure was in fact also a cover story, like the manganese nodules, and the CIA did in fact recover everything, and hurrah for America. I don't buy that one, but whatever. Another.
First of all, that's not even trying.
Right, yeah.
You're making it.
Sounds like that's Richard Helms's story.
Yeah, because why do you need a cover story for having succeeded?
And they say, can I see the code book that you recovered? And he says, you don't have coverage for that. You don't even have the security compartment coverage to know about it.
Yeah, go talk to my secretary, Jennifer Azorian.
Jennifer Azorian, she'll set you right. So the Glomar Explorer had a sister ship called the Glomar Challenger that launched in 1970 and was out mapping the Mid-Atlantic Ridge during this period. And so maybe it's a head fake and the Glomar Challenger is out with its own giant claw, Clementine II, and it's recovering Atlantis. And so that Azorian existed to draw the Soviets away from the Glomar Challenger during its recovery of Atlantis, which that one's strong.
It does seem like one very expensive claw too many.
I agree, but you know, once you've got the Glomar Explorer's sister ship in the Atlantic, that's pretty strong. I enjoy it.
Well, once you've got a Glomar claw, you have to make Glomar claw aid. That's
exactly
true.
Right. Yes. So the book Red Star Rogue by Kenneth Sewell and Clint Richmond proposes that the K-129 sank during an attempted nuclear launch on Hawaii that Suslov and Andropov intended to blame on China, and thus triggering LBJ to launch on China and solve the Mao problem. And I think that they are also on Team Azorian actually worked, but it had to cover up the near Soviet start of nuclear war to keep, you know, detente and everything going. And so that's their sort of theory. Another one is that in the same waters north of Hawaii, a U.S. Navy destroyer allegedly shot down a UFO in 1973, and that Azorian was just going after that UFO and not after the Soviet sub at all. The Soviet sub was an excuse, because certainly the Soviet sub, according to later searches on the bottom, seems to have sunk not where the CIA said Azorian was. Now, maybe Azorian moved, but I don't know. Bob Lazar, beloved crank and whistleblower of Area 51, says that Azorian was actually mining element 115 from the seabed for UFO engines at Area 51. So you got your manganese nodules, but instead of manganese, it's element 115 nodules. And I think that's pretty cool. If you like the UFO, maybe it's a ship with a pilot. It's an alien spacecraft. This is Harry Turtledove's theory in the novel 3 Miles Down, and it's a millennia-old spacecraft that's been in stasis during that time, and that it shot down the Soviet sub. Its automatic defenses did that, and that's why they had to bring a claw instead of a submarine. I'm not sure what sense that makes, but there we are. It's a fun novel, and it gets you some sort of, you were there about the Azorian ship.
Right. For another media echo of this incident, the sunken Soviet sub from which you must retrieve a MacGuffin is a big part of the last two Mission Impossible movies. So this is still floating around, as it were, lodged on the seabed of our pop culture consciousness.
And then finally, people over fixate on the K-129 because it was only one of four submarines that disappeared in early 1968. The Israeli sub Dakar sank off Crete on January 25th. The French sub Minerve left Toulon on January 27th and was never ever seen again. And of course, the K-129 goes down on the 7th of March, and the USS Scorpion sinks off the Azores on May 22nd. And some people say that the Soviets took out the Scorpion in retaliation for us taking out the K-129. Other, more sober-minded observers say it was Deep Ones, that the Deep Ones came after us, and that possibly the Scorpion started that war with the Deep Ones, and that's what the Glomar Challenger was up to there in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, was going after the Deep Ones. And I like that story best of all.
That could mean that the files stolen from Hughes' corporate office in 74 detailed his arrangement with the Deep Ones, his contacts with them.
Yeah.
Because if anyone by the end of his life had the Innsmouth look, it could be Howard Hughes. Maybe that explained all of his problems, because we know he was obsessed by Ice Station Zebra, another submarine-related movie, and possibly that was all about the Deep Ones signaling to Howard to come back after he'd made his fortune and made all this money that they could use in Deep One operations.
Right, that this was them sort of tugging on the string of his operation, telling him that he needed to come back and live in wonder and glory forever under the sea instead of sitting in a dark room eating banana nut ice cream and saving his urine.
Well, that offers many different possibilities, especially for 70s post-fall Delta Green, or possibly you could do it as a Moondust Men 70s scenario, and it gives you your submarine action, it gives you a little Watergate connection, it gives you a heist. So there's all sorts of possibilities for adventure and weirdness. And having supplied them, it's time to move to a commercial, and then guess what? A third hut.
What?
Caught in the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Defray the cost of our submersibles by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Darren Hennessy,
Manfred Gabriel,
Liz and Siski,
Robbie Carlton,
and James Candelino.
The bay leaves burning on the brazier, the goggle-eyed demons looming out of the red-painted kylix, the stern reminder that other places have mythology, not just Greece, can welcome us once more into the Mythology Hut. And today in the Mythology Hut, we're going to talk about a myth who wasn't a myth, but now he's a myth, the Green Man. And I think virtually everything we're going to say in this segment is a gigantic hat tip, a deep, respectful bow yes. to Ronald Hutton, who sort of lays this all out in the epilogue to his great book, Queens of the Wild, Pagan Goddesses in Europe. And he goes and he right. finds...
And so the thesis of this whole book is that myths about wild or goddess-like women or both in Europe that are thought to be very old and a continuation of archaic myth, in fact, are generally all more recent than you think, because culture doesn't slowly evolve over thousands of years. It ping-pongs around, or I guess billiard balls around in weird directions, and it's a recurring theme of this show, of our particularly of Consulting Occultists, that traditions that wrap themselves in a cloak of archaic splendor often are relatively recent. And this one is extremely recent, and he sort of tacks it on to the end of a book about goddesses just because it fits his real theme of everything being relatively recent and created in part of the eternal and much shorter than you think cycle of culture. And in particular here, unlike genuinely old myths, we can look at the particular person in the particular year who wound up through back projection and theorizing, making up a modern myth about a nature god.
And that person was a lady named Julia Somerset, and she was the third wife of Lord Raglan. So she's Lady Raglan to her friends. And in 1939, she publishes an article in Folklore, a magazine or the journal Folklore, positing that the foliate head motif in English Gothic Revival and other medieval churches, which is a head covered in, surrounded by exuding, spitting out vegetation, depicts a god figure known as the Green Man, and that the Green Man also shows up in the Mayday figure called Jack in Green, shows up in the Green Man pub signs, shows up in the Wild Man of the Woods, or the Woe to Woes, depending on who you're reading, and in Robin Hood, and in Charles II hiding in the oak tree, and is, in general, the Summer King from our buddy J.G. Frazier.
Right, and if you look at the names of pubs, you will find Green Man pubs long before 1939. It was a standard pub name. For example, in the Georgian era, there were a whole bunch of them, but it did not refer to the leafy guy who looked sort of like the English forebear of the Jolly Green Giant. It was a human, a forester or a ranger or a gamekeeper. So that is an example of a unrelated mundane thing becoming retroactively supernatural through back projection.
Right. And while we're discussing the Raglan family, we should not let Lord Raglan get by without a kick in the head, because as we mentioned in our Joseph Campbell deconstruction episode, he was patient zero for the hero with a thousand faces. So two bogus myths, one family, no waiting.
Right. And Hutton is really, I think, getting into the Green Man, both because it fits his thesis, but because he went for a whole book without kicking James Frazer.
Right.
And so he points out the fascinating way that the idea of the Green Man created sort of a lifeboat for Fraserian ideas, even as mainstream academics were turning against him and rejecting him. So this is near the end of his life, and people who had gone off and done more research were rejecting his idea of sort of eternal patterns of religion and the Corn King, who is then reconfigured as Christ. And again, they're saying, I doubt your police work there, James Frazer. But because Lady Raglan skips all of that baggage and just makes a much more modest claim, the idea of the Green Man being the survival of a pagan nature god continues to propagate because the overt Fraserness has been scrubbed off of it.
Yeah. And after Lady Raglan, other people sort of followed along. As you say, the lifeboat bobbed along the waters of pop culture and sort of middlebrow intellectuals. Later, people added the Green Knight from Gawain and the Green Knight and Peter Pan as part of the Green Man mythos. They're like, oh, you forgot these. And there is an Islamic legend, sort of a wonder-working figure called Al-Qadr, the Green One, and he was immortal, and he met Alexander the Great, and he had all kind of cool adventures. But maybe, since he's green, he's part of the Green Man. Maybe that's what's going on, and the Green Man is even bigger than Europe. And how exciting would that be? Kingsley Amis, in this sort of high-water note of the Green Man in 1969, writes a great sort of dark satirical ghost story about a haunting by the Green Man, and he haunts a pub called the Green Man. And so the novel is called The Green Man. It's about this horrible haunting, and it's about how this ghost is terrible, but so are all the people in the pub because it's Kingsley Amis. And so that is worth reading, even if Julia Somerset's article is not. But also in the 60s, the Green Man has become a symbol of the hippies and then sort of an ecological mascot adopted by various movements around the world. And a poet named William Anderson in 1990 does a sort of a lush photo book taking pictures of lots of foliate heads and pub signs and all kinds of other things about the Green Man being the myth that we need during our ecologically parlous times. And this is in 1990, and the BBC, always one to elevate a dumb narrative, does a whole special on it called Return of the Green Man that blows up in the 90s. And that is how it gets into the tiny little head of Charles III, King of England, and the Green Man shows up on the invitations to his coronation of his and Camilla's as a timeless symbol of British regard for nature, which it is not, but, you know, whatever. I mean, if you can't add a nonsensical anachronism to your monarch, what can you add it to?
Yes, it's a brand new anachronism. Right. And so I think the appeal here is that, A, I think the connection to nature continues to appeal. It's a new way for connecting romanticism to mythology. And also that this is specifically British, mm-hmm. because it was made up in Britain, and therefore I think that accounts for the continuance of the Green Man. And why not? He seems kind of fun. And unless he's haunting the pub that you foolishly named after him, yeah, relatively benign.
Just to sort of close it off, the Folliot head turns out to descend from a bunch of different sources and took many forms. And at no point did anyone carving Folliot heads write down, this is actually representing Christ or anything like they did for half the other stuff they carved. They were just like, hey, Green Mans are cool. Let's put them in. Let's put in a Folliot head. But
well, I think leaves are fun to carve and faces are fun to carve. So face with leaves makes sense.
So there is a scholar named Rabanus Morris who wrote a document about the leaves of sin choking man. It was a very popular sermon. And so the leaves are sometimes choking the guy. There's in the Golden Legend of Vorain in the 1300s, there was a story that Seth planted seeds in the head of Adam and the tree of the cross grew out of it. And so you can have, that's the head of Adam and that's why there's a tree growing out of him. But Hutton likes the argument that there was a movement in Kashmir to depict a form of Vishnu called the Vaikuntha Vishnu with lotus blossoms all around him, and that this very striking image appealed to the Abbasids, and they drew it, and it got passed iconographically to Europe through the Arab countries. And since the first post-classical Folliot head, there used to be pictures of Oceanus and Bacchus with various leaves around them, but that was a different thing and had died out by the 500s. The first post-classical Folliot head appears in 900 AD in Spain, so that would apply a transmission from the Arabs. And then also the Folliot head goes crazy during the Crusades. That's when you get all the Folliot heads start showing up, including some very fancy ones in Cyprus. And so the notion is, yeah, this is probably a Arabic decorative motif that they got from India that the Europeans got from the Arabs. And it, as you say, leaves are fun to carve. Faces are fun to carve. What's funner than a face with leaves? Nothing.
So it may well be that you could do a period esoterrorist piece, because this is classic esoterrorist stuff where a fake thing becomes real through magic. And so the Green Man could be very interesting to them, either in 39, when he is being invented and giving this sort of false provenance, or again in 1990s when the TV special airs. And so this could be sort of a beginning of their power. And it could be that, you know, just slapping Green Man on everything just adds a little bit of zhush to whatever working you're trying to do as an esoterrorist, because it's one of the original versions of one of their common operations. And so that could be something to look out for when you're a member of the Ordo Veritatis. Does this person have a tile with the face of the Green Man on it as a set of coasters because they are in league with the esoterrorists, or just because they like to protect the environment or are interested in British culture? So that could be an interesting little symbol that could mean one thing or could mean the opposite. And having supplied our little game hook detail, it's time to listen to a commercial and then the final hut. The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. appropriately enough, this final hut is the one that's sort of like a bit of every other hut, the one where we're not really sure what's going on because there's a crank over in the corner. And this time the crank, he's got a money counter because he's making bank. I think he's a pseudo-archaeologist. And when I look out the window and hear the alien big cat screaming, I think he's screaming in annoyance. And over in the corner, there's the gray alien, the Nordic alien. They're perky as always when they know that the Elliptony hut is going to bring them in. Yes, indeed, it's the Elliptony hut. And this time around, we're going to cover yet another thing that I was surprised not to have covered before. We've surely mentioned him in reference to other Elliptonic topics. But we're going to look at the career of the recently deceased pseudo-archaeologist Erich von Däniken. And he's, I think, probably the biggest popularizer of pseudo-archaeology that we've seen ever. He was
ever.
Didn't make it up, but he really, really promoted it. So he's born in 1935 in Switzerland, in Zofingen. And his early interests are definitely in line with where his career went.
Yeah, he, in later self-aggrandizing interviews, was saying that he rejected his Catholic school teachings and preferred astronomy and space and flying saucers. And this is perhaps where the mantle of scientific defender falls a little loose. But he does leave Catholic school, not necessarily because of his convictions. Well, actually, specifically because of his convictions, in that he's convicted of theft in 1954. He gets a suspended sentence, and the examining psychiatrist diagnoses his tendency to lie, which is a lovely bit of foreshadowing, if you will. So his dad takes him out of school. He apprentices him to a hotelier. And from that hotel, he scampers off to Egypt and gets involved in a jewelry scheme, resulting in another jail sentence, this one 9 months, for fraud and embezzlement. And according to him later, he experienced an intense vision in the jail, but he never described it, which I think is, you know, good for him, but not in character. But anyway, I think this is sort of stolen visionary valor. He gets back out. Maybe the vision told him that they were desperate for hotel keepers in Davos, because he's managed to get a hotel job despite two convictions for fraud. So he gets this job in Davos in 1956. Again, I guess maybe Davos just loves frauds. What are you going to do? He spends 12 years at the hotel job, and he's taking frequent trips to research his ancient astronaut theories. And someone finally looks into it and says, "You've been taking a lot of trips on an assistant hotel keeper's salary." "Oh, right. You were stealing money from the hotel and embezzling it from the guests. Once more, you're in trouble." But during this peripatetic period, he writes Chariots of the Gods between 1964 and 1966. And I guess we should say the
question mark at the end of the title is silent, but it's there.
Right.
And is perhaps a tip off as punctuation goes.
He sends it to a bunch of publishers, all of whom reject it. And finally, a publisher called Econ Verlag accepts it, but they send it for a massive rewrite by a guy named Utz Uttermann, who is not rewriting it under that name, because under the name of Utz Uttermann, he was the editor of the Völkischer Beobachter, the Nazi paper. So fun follows when. And let's just say that things he doesn't edit out of Chariots of the Gods are the racist core of the book. Econ Verlag does probably recognize its massive plagiarism from Morning of the Magicians by Powells and Bergier, which came out in 1960, and possibly also from 100,000 Years of Man's Unknown History by a French author named Robert Charroux. That's from 1963. But they move ahead, they publish Chariots, and it becomes a massive global bestseller. Morning of the Magicians did pretty great. Chariots breaks those records, selling 7 million copies.
And do you have a theory as to what it was about this rejiggered version of other material that led to it taking off around the world? Is there something about von Däniken or Uttermann's repackaging that made it perfectly saleable where the other stuff wasn't?
I think there's a couple of reasons. One, it comes out in 1968 when people are much stupider than they were in 1963. Let me rephrase. More eager to believe nonsense than they were in 1963.
Taking more hallucinogens?
Perhaps. Or society is giving up more obviously. I think also it's punchier. I think Uttermann probably, you know, tightened up the prose an awful lot. Charroux wanders all over the place. Powells and Bergier, very hard to keep a through line going because they have so much stuff they want to put in.
Well, I certainly want to believe that better editing made this a smash.
Letterman or Daniken sort of focused down on a few core anomalies as opposed to giving you hundreds of them the way that Charu and Powells did.
Right. He did have a great eye for picking sticky images that would appeal to a broad audience, including the pyramids being built by aliens,
yep,
that the Nazca lines could only be made by someone with an aerial craft, when, of course, it is established, or you could walk around and make them with your shoe, that Stonehenge and other sites use math too advanced for the civilizations that built them. That's basic numerology, where you add a bunch of numbers to something to make it seem significant. He certainly, I think the movie version of this in particular, really hit UFO circles by having people associate Ezekiel's wheel with the UFO. And whether he's the first one to do that, he's the one who really made that pop. And you still see today that as the, you know, big biblical UFO. Famously, he took the lid of a Mayan sarcophagus, the sarcophagus of Palenque, and described it as depicting an ancient astronaut in a capsule. And so in the era of the Apollo space missions, which maybe also is a timing issue as to why this took off, you could look at that and go, yeah, that's kind of an astronaut, I guess, unless you're a Mayanist, in which you say, I don't even understand why he picked this one. They all look like this. What's the deal? The one that I remember was his account of alien remains being found in a Chinese cave and covered up by the authorities. And of course, at this time in history, you could claim all sorts of things going on in China and not get any pushback on. And I did read these books when I was in high school because my dad was really into them. And this was sort of his gateway into being a longtime UFO buff. And so somehow Eric von Daniken, you know, reached ordinary people like my dad, and the movie version played for a fair while in a theater in my small town. So this really busted wide.
Yeah, it blew up. I was another, you know, von Daniken head back in the day. There's other anomalies in the book, but, you know, those are certainly the headliners. And I think my recollection is that he did more to sort of overtly tie it to the Bible than other sorts of books at the time did. It's not all the way through Bible stuff, but there's definitely more sort of, hey kids, this is in the Bible, therefore it's real.
There is a big overlap between UFO buffery and Bible study, for sure.
Right.
The film is from 1970, one of the earliest pseudo-documentaries, perhaps the original pseudo-documentary to do BAFO business. It made $24 million domestic on its original release, which in today's numbers is 160 million. So that would be a substantial hit, although, you know, not a giant blockbuster.
And then, as you say, it played over and over and over. So initial release is 25 million, but
right,
it was playing throughout the 1970s, certainly in Oklahoma.
Yeah, it had legs.
Yeah.
And it was one of several films of this stripe. Also the Hal Lindsey's late Great Planet Earth adaptation. It's sort of a more overtly biblical and apocalyptic pseudo-documentary. Both of those used the four-wall method, where the distributor would rent theaters, often in small locations. This is before all theaters were parts of big chains, and they would maximize their profits by renting the entire hall. So they would, apart from the rental fee, take the whole amount, and they would blanket an area with a promotion, then move on to another small town. And so this is also a story of how the film distributors kept this alive and then fed the sales of all of his other subsequent books.
Yeah. So returning to this fun story of von Daniken, you may remember that he had been committing a great deal of fraud and embezzlement in order to pay for his lux lifestyle and alien researches. So he goes back to trial for fraud in November of 68. He's convicted in 1970, despite a defense in which he says, the credit company should have looked into me better. It's their fault, which I love. Goes back to prison again. The court-appointed psychiatrist describes him as a liar and psychopath, for people collecting apt descriptions of Eric von Daniken. He serves a year of his sentence, during which he writes Gods from Outer Space, the next one, pays off his victims with His book earnings pays $130,000, which is over $1 million in today money. And he's out in 1971. And as you say,
investment in UFO research and pseudoarchaeology, it paid off.
Yeah. No, I mean, as a brand building exercise, there's nothing wrong with Chariots of the Gods. As everything else, yeah, probably. So, he then wrote 21 more books that basically either rehash the original or zoom in on one topic or another. I remember one called Gold of the Gods, which I'm pretty sure I own. And then sometimes there'd be an archaeological site in the news and he would rush out a new gods book. So Pathways to the Gods is about some stuff that was found in the Kiribati island chain in the Pacific. And sometimes he just does the same book over again, but he has better photos because this time the publisher's paying instead of hotel guests. So in his lifetime, his publishers estimate that they have sold 70 million copies of his books, which is pretty good. He even had a theme park called Mystery Park in Interlaken in Switzerland that opened in 2003. The good news, Robin, is that it closed in 2006 because no one wanted to go to a Chariots of the Gods theme park, even one in Interlaken, Switzerland. So he died as he lived in 2026 at age 90, full of lies and money. And that was the salutary and perhaps minatory story of Eric von Däniken, who, speaking of making up myths, took other people's myths and made something up around them and sort of redirected pop culture in a way that it still hasn't recovered from. I mean, they're still rebooting Stargate, and that's basically refurbished Chariots of the Gods stuff.
Right. And Graham Hancock follows in his footsteps.
Oh, absolutely.
And all sorts of other elliptonic authors on your shelves. And now there's a whole generation of TikTokers basically mining the same appealing and also, as we said previously, pretty racist theories, because he sort of made it all accessible to normies. And at its core, it's about, I know more than everybody else does. I know what all of these things really mean. There's a simple story, but it's a simple secret story that only I and possibly 70 million other readers know about.
Yep. I guess we should sort of signpost, you know, the specific racism is that this is, well, surely Africans couldn't have built Great Zimbabwe or the pyramids of Cheops. It had to be aliens. Couldn't have been South Americans that built Tiwanaku. It must have been aliens. It couldn't have been Mexicans that built Teotihuacan. It must have been aliens. And I guess Stonehenge, in theory, was built by putatively European folk. But to von Däniken, I'm sure he didn't believe that the proto-Celts or whoever was banging around Britain in Stonehenge times counted either. So it's kind of a, you know, contemptible thesis, despite the degree of fun that one can have with it.
Right. And there's bits of the theosophical root races thing
All
mixed up in there as well. So there's, other threads of occultism that, you know, undoubtedly he read some Blavatsky and other people from the 19th century.
He mentions the Book of Zion a great deal in Chariots. So it's clearly he's got some Blavatsky going on.
So you can have somebody being into Chariots and pseudo-archaeology as a sign that they're attuned to whatever forces are at work in your setting, or, you know, but misunderstanding them, because, of course, he didn't uncover real, he doesn't find the real ancient beings who, he doesn't mention the fungi from Yuggoth, but clearly these are all possibly screen memories for these in a Lovecraftian world, or, again, another version of making your own reality and making it come magically true, as you would have in the esoterists.
And you could always say that Utz Utterman, when he's editing Chariots, is inserting the secret, you know, vortexes of the earth discovered by the Annenerbe in World War II. And what von Däniken, unbeknownst to him, is doing is providing the secret Fourth Reich treasure hunters with the blueprint to recover the telluric patterns of force on the world. And you, the cool multiracial hippie types, are the only people who can stop them in sort of a 70s Odessa-file type action where you're going after horrendous Nazis who are using Chariots of the Gods as a blueprint. And you have to use the powerful earth energies of the locals to defeat this awful Fourth Reich plot. And then Chariots becomes the big, colorful backdrop that I think it is best suited for.
Right. And I wouldn't put it past vampires to four-wall theaters in order to, you know, recruit people who are susceptible to being Renfieldized as well, so they could be involved with that. And they could certainly have Nazi connections as well.
Right.
Well, having come not to praise Erich von Däniken, but to bury him, we've done that. And it's time for us to call another episode to a close, but there'll be yet a following one a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Palgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/CanAndRobin.
Baffle future pseudo-archaeologists by joining such backers as
Jesse Lowe,
Michael Hawkins,
Derek McMullen,
Will Ferguson, and Fifi Payat,
and John W.S. Marvin.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again, we will talk about stuff.